said earlier that
There are lands in Southeast Alaska held in trust.
They're very small lands, yeah. Like cannery lands and places where they kept their boats in the winter and stuff like that. They're very small plots of land, but that is their land, and they can build businesses on it. They can do anything at all they want with it, and at least it's theirs.
You mean you're speaking of allotments?
No, lands in trust for the village.
I see.
They're Klawak has several lots, and Heidelberg has several lots, and there are several other villages in Southeastern that have title that is held in trust by the United States government. By the way, you know, people talk about trust a lot in Alaska, and legally with American Indians, and because Alaska Native law and federal law is just being developed, because we really, for all intents and purposes, really haven't gotten much consideration through the years, is just being developed up here, but there are very few things that are actually in trust in Alaska for Alaska Natives. We have a reindeer herd that is held in trust in the title of the United States. Every reindeer that's out there, you know, in the Nana region, its title is held in trust by the United States government for the benefit of Alaska Natives. We have restricted and interim conveyed restricted property that are treated as trust property, and there's a little over 1 million acres at the present time that is, you know, restricted. It is not trust like some of the old cannery properties that were under IRA and primarily in southeastern Alaska. But those lands have never been touched, nor have our native allotment lands been touched. So for all intents and purposes, that is the only individual lands, you know, the individual has gotten free and clear from the federal government. But for all intents and purposes, it really isn't working out that well, because most Alaska Natives go out and do things collectively. They go out and dig clams collectively. They go out and pick berries collectively. They go out and hunt collectively. You know, they need collective lands to do these kinds of things that is life to them, you know. Life for a white person is very different than life and really being able to enjoy your life. I mean, white people work all of their life to live the way an Alaska Native does in the village from the time he's born. And that to them is living, where it might not be your idea of living. You might feel like you're wasting your life. They are fulfilling their need for that type of life, like you are doing your thing. And they do feel that they are part of the land. When I'm back home in Heidelberg, I do too. You know, I feel just like it's my land, even though I know it isn't anymore. But the Native Allotment Program, you know, which was a very, very poor program up until ANCSA, and then in the last days of ANCSA, they registered over 5,000 Alaska Natives. And it was very difficult to, even though we sent Natives out to get people to sign up for Native Allotment, it was very difficult. They would say, well, you know, my uncle and my aunt, we all go out there. It's not just mine. So even though we got 5,000 people registered, you know, there was another 55,000 that didn't register for their 150 acres, which is really a white man's idea, you know, 150 acres. That's how they gave away Oklahoma and Nevada and Wyoming. You know, they gave them out in 150 and 320 acre slots. And it's very difficult for Alaska Natives to think of, you know, that's my little piece of property. You know, 150 acres, they look out, you know, like my grandfather would say, that's, you know, Haida land for as far as you can see here and as far as you can see there. And that's Haida country. And it's very difficult when they think that way to come in and say, you better go out and stake out 150 acres or you're not going to have anything. So it was a very, very unsuccessful program until the crush of ANCSA. And everyone knew it was going to pass, and they told, and we had a big program to get out there and get Natives signed up for it. So that's the only individual lands that they really have and own. And if it's in restricted title, they're very fortunate because no one can take it away from them, and no one can tax it.
Could I ask another question that the subject of native self-government keeps coming up at these hearings, and Mr. Strong from Klukwan brought it up today. One of the things that Native people in Canada want to have control over is education, and so they have programs in every province of Canada to train Native persons to be teachers, and so that they can teach in schools in Native communities. And the federal government in Canada in the early 70s adopted the policy that Native communities should have self-determination in education, that is, control over curriculum and hiring, firing of teachers, and seasonal scheduling, so that the children wouldn't be obliged to come to school when their family was out fishing, and so on. And the U.S. Congress adopted the same policy at about the same time, I think. And I was wondering if you, with your experience in Native education in Alaska, could just tell me, if you don't mind, a little bit about the history of that movement in Alaska and how it's turned out.
When we were in D.C., to give sort of a historical perspective to it, when we were in D.C. in 1970 and 71 during the ANCSA passage, I attended a lot of educational hearings, primarily because the ANCSA hearings would get so terribly boring. So I would run over to HEW and I would attend all these different hearings, and I found out about bilingual education, Indian education, and all these other things that tribal people from all over were getting involved with. So when I came back to Alaska and was finishing up my degree, I got involved with Fairbanks Native Association with their education committee, and we took over Johnson O'Malley and Indian education and all of these. And we were doing so well with it, we thought, well, since they're working on the Constitution and all this stuff, let's also get education going at AFN, because other than the land, education is the most important thing. So we got it into the whole AFN thing, you know, that, and it was a very, very important part of AFN, and in fact, they still, that is one of the few programs that they still have left is education. Anyway, we had a statewide Johnson O'Malley committee, of which I was chairman for about 2.5 years, and which in fact was the first bucks that were used to fund all of the nonprofits around the state. We took the $7.5 million and divided it based on how many Native students were, like in Southeast Agency, then Tlingit and Haida would get so many million, and how many you know, Native kids in the Tanana region and stuff like that. So we divided it up as what we thought was very judicious, and, you know, which had never been done before. Before that, the Bureau of Indian Affairs used to take the Johnson O'Malley check and go up to Department of Education and hand it over to the Commissioner of Education, and the Commissioner of Education would then use that money to send Indians out of state to boarding schools where they didn't have to pay for us. And the federal government was giving them Johnson O'Malley monies to educate us in public schools. PL 874 monies, which is monies for non-taxable federal lands, which is used for military and Indian students, was also a big pile of bucks, millions of dollars that came into the state to educate Indians, that was given to the territory and to the state of Alaska, which was the basic dollar where they started their state foundation program, and where they would give so many dollars to public schools, and they were supposedly educating military and Indians as well as everybody else. But what was happening is The Department of Education, and back in territorial days, was using this money to ship Indians to Indian boarding schools in the state and out of state. So we stopped them from doing that. We told the Bureau of Indian Affairs that that's not legal. You don't have an Indian parent committee. You don't have anybody at all telling you how that money is to be spent. So we organized all of these committees all over. We were rather naive in those days. We used to pay our own fare and pay other people's fare and raise money and everything. We didn't know that there were such things as government programs or anything, you know, to pay for these things. Anyway, we went around and I, you know, like I paid my way out to Dillingham, and we sent Brenda Etta up to Barrow, and we organized all of these people, and we would have them apply for these different monies to take it into the BIA down here in Juneau and say, see, these natives do want to say so on, you know, their own educational programs and everything. So we stopped them from sending the kids out of the state, and we had a within-state boarding home program. At the same time, every time we would go out to these areas, they'd say to us, you know, we want to have more say in our schools, but we want to have Inupiat language, we want to have Athabascan, we want to have culture, we want to have all these things. So then we applied to the state, and then state-operated school said, you know, this might be a pretty good thing, so will you come to work for us, and you can be the Indian Education Director, and we'll give you $7.5 million. Well, that was just like, boy, I'd never, you know, because we were fumbling around for a few hundred thousand dollars here and a few hundred thousand dollars there. And at that time, we were concerned about Native teachers and all, but we were more concerned with getting local teachers right into the school immediately. You know, in those days, we had about 5,500 kids every day, every single school year coming into schools that were non-English speaking without a bilingual teacher there. So our immediate concern was to get, you know, 2 and 3 week training programs for all of these bilingual teachers, teachers who could speak English and their own language, and get them into the classroom. And mind you, we were trying to do this over 150 schools. Then after we did that, they said, hey, we can't teach school with bilingual programs without books and without the language being developed. And I said, well, let's start with, they already have Yupik pretty well developed and they're working on Inupiat. Let's go into Athabascan next. So we set aside a big chunk of money for that. Then the linguists started working on it. We found out there were 23 dialects, like 23 different languages, and they were all Athabascan. And then we had Tlingit and Haida, and we started out with Eyak because that was the thing the state was concerned about. We only had 3 Eyaks left in the world. So we got the languages developed, and then we needed expertise for people to put these languages into book and on grade level and on and on and on. Anyway, it was sort of a non-ending battle. In the meantime, we found out that there is no such thing as a bilingual program for teachers. And we looked all over the world. We looked in Canada. We looked in Greenland. We looked all over, and we had exchanges back and forth and all. In fact, I went to a meeting in Quebec and once in Ottawa. And we met with educators and communicators, and we met a couple of Eskimo teachers, and I think one of them was the first one that was ever graduated, and the next one was her niece or something. And I knew that we had certainly had far more Native teachers than that, but these were unique. They were educated in their language and everything, same concept as the Greenlandic teachers. But we got a lot of opposition from the University of Alaska. For one thing, we do not have a curriculum. We don't have written history. We don't have what they considered a written language like French, where they could take a book and develop it on grade level, say kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and not only that, but in all the subject areas. So not only would we have to have a Native teacher who went to college for 4 years, then she would have to go through another 4 years in order to get proficient in all those different course areas. So that was probably our most unsuccessful thing that we did, was was trying to get the university to change its attitude. Instead of that, they had us buy videotapes where a videotape could be put in a village and they could train the teacher off a videotape, which we thought was pretty rank, but that was the way they treated us, you know. We didn't know any better, so we let them treat us that way, you know. And so a lot of our rural teachers were taught off those videotapes, and then we expected them to be as proficient as other teachers. But we did get all the languages developed. We did get cultural programs. We did get the rural people into the classroom. We did make the whole Native education movement happen. You know, we got it down to the local level. But we haven't been very successful, and from what I understand, Canada having about as much trouble as we do, because it is a very, very difficult area. You know, it's absolutely amazing. You can take a UPIC student in the first grade and show them a book of UPIC, and if you've ever seen those words, they are long. They're up to 50 and 60 letters long, and those kids, you know, they just read. And then by the third and the fourth grade, when you're switching them over to English, to see them struggle and stammer and, you know, have such trouble with it and is and as and the, you know, it's incredible that we have taught school in Alaska for almost 100 years and didn't know what we were doing to all these kids coming to school not speaking English. You know, you have all this baggage of language with you when you come to school, the English-speaking child, that a native child just doesn't have, and it certainly doesn't have after 3 years of an hour or two of English during the day. You know, so it was amazing to me. They only put us 2 years behind in school. You know, we should have been 8 years after 8 years of school. But our most unsuccessful effort is in the area of teachers and bilingual and bicultural teachers. And there's also a lot of subtle opposition to it. I mean, they make an Alaska Native, and I won't even mention where it is in Alaska, but, you know, they make him the head of education and everything, and you go out there and there's no Native students, no Native programs, no Native anything. I mean, you know, how subtle is that? I mean, do you have to be hit with a brick wall? And so I would say that we're a colossal failure in that area. Matter of fact, in getting Natives into the general life of Alaska, you know, where employment opportunities are, such as state government and education, we are a colossal failure as Natives because of the very real discrimination against Alaska Natives. Alaska Natives work for Native corporations, and they work for Native organizations. They are very, very few and far between that are in the other industries and in the other large employers in Alaska, and that's the state and federal government and education. And there are very, very few Natives in those fields, other than those things having to do with Natives. So not only is our teacher program a colossal failure, the other area of employment is also. Is that all?
Yeah. Thanks very much. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Strong?
I'd like to say something about some of the houses.
Please do.
My name is Gene Strong, and I'm temporarily employed for a housing authority in Southeast, and my job is to do maintenance on the frustration marks and damages that's done on the houses. It's part of the whole thing, as I see it. It's frustration from the people that lived in the houses, like she was saying, that the way I felt was the same thing as what she was saying, is that the federal government looked at the villages and seen that we was in substandard houses, so they said they were going to give us all new houses to stay in. But now we're finding out we have to pay into those houses on our own land, and we can't do, you know, we have to get, you know, if they can't afford to pay, like she said, we get kicked out of those houses on our own land. And we never, it was supposed to have been given to us the way I thought it was, but getting back to where my position is as a maintenance man, I get to look at the construction of the buildings, you know, the inside of the things, you know, the skeleton of the building and the interior and the exterior and the foundations. And I know a little bit about some of the codes, which I've learned when I was in Lower 48, learning my trade as mechanic and kind of fix-it-all man for all different fields that I felt I'd need to be in to be Alaskan, to be part of this new world, of the world of cash economy. But the houses themselves are really poorly put together. There, it looks to me like we had a block of money from the federal government, HUD House, and then they took around and looked around for contractors to build the houses, as many as houses you can get out of this block of money. And from what I understand, they finally got a contractor from Oregon, or somewhere around there. Part of it was in Oregon, part of it was Seattle, but it's in material for this part of it, that they did make a lot of houses political. You know, part of it was political, because they could say, well, look at federal government, we made these many houses out of this many dollars, you know, so we're shining. You know, we look real good on that part of it. But then nowadays, the houses aren't even 10 years old, and the foundations are sinking. The foundations are made of piling. They were driven into rock. They were driven in, you know, like up in our area in Klukwan, it's all iron ore and big iron ore boulders. And they take the creosote piling and try to drive them in as far as they could. And then they just cut the splintered ends off and put the houses on top of that. Other portions of the villages are in softer ground, and they're sinking. There's houses in Klukwan that was built on swamps that we had never built anything on, and they drove 90-foot pilings in there, and water just squirted up 120 feet. And those houses are sagging, and, you know, just really poor construction. And we, at the time of those houses were being done, it looks apparent to me that the engineers that was hired to put these buildings in had no knowledge of the or didn't take any ground analysis of the areas that they're going to put these buildings on. So consequently, we got all the houses are, the doors don't open, or they, you know, they're always, the floors are all swelling up, or they're sagging down, or the walls are cracking. But then when you have to go in there after this few years to see what you can do to fix them, well, then you got nothing to work with, because there's the foundation that is under there is just like the houses are on toothpicks or stilts. There actually isn't a cribbing underneath the foundation. That's, the houses are built on floor joists, which are just set on top of the piling, and those aren't even fastened to the piling. And the electrical is of aluminum wire, which under Oregon code would probably have been okay, but the standard code's been changing, and now those wires are two grades under, or two sizes under. And then on top of that, or one size under if it's aerial. And when we have them buried now, and that, so it's two sizes too small. And being of aluminum takes a lot more energy to push that same voltage through those wires. The electrical outlets are outlawed or illegal, I'd say, in Alaska code, but it was okay for a short time in Oregon, but I found out those were outlawed, the kind of where you just push the wire in the back of the receptacle. Because now that I've been doing this maintenance work, I'm finding most of those are burning off because it's not a positive connection. And people plug in, because they're so ill insulated. I mean, at first they had this liquid insulation they squirted in the walls, but that shrunk up to where you have almost 6 inches of gap on top of the walls where there's no insulation, and the floor insulation is fell down to the second outer layer floor. So actually there's no insulation underneath your floor, because when I moved into them, you step on the floor and my feet just arches right up because it's so cold. But those wall sockets and the switches are flimsy. Someone made a lot of dollars out of these buildings. And partially because maybe it's our ignorance, but another thing was we're supposed to trust these people that build these things, and we never question it. Because we know as our own self, we trust one another, or we know who that we don't trust. But we always had faith in all of our own beings. And we never thought we'd have to second guess this from another non-native or whoever it was that constructed these buildings. We always thought they'd be in A1 condition and wouldn't have any of these problems. And those are part of the reasons why I see there's a lot of frustration marks, is now those people have to pay for something that isn't worth a hoot to pay for in the beginning. They're only single entrance buildings. They're like matchboxes. And they're so high up off the ground, and the windowsills are high, the kids can't even break out, much less the elderly people.
In case of fire,
right. Because I've done a demonstration with this organization to try to dive out the window or climb out the window. And the windows are such where they open up and they cut the window spaces in half. So you can't really squeeze out. I feel I'm in somewhat fair condition and I have a hard time to squeeze out past the windows. But once you get up in the windows, then you got nothing to grab a hold of. So the kids would get stuck, because they wouldn't jump out because it's 10 feet down. But the two halves of the building are put together with twist wire nuts, which we have to go back and tighten. And we're still having these problems with the electrical systems because they're just substandard. And I guess it's, these are the things that we have to contend with. And these are some of the frustrations that we feel from receiving these good tidings from the Great White Father. He's supposed to be doing us a favor, and then we find out it wasn't such a good favor. But this is what we have to work with now, and we're trying to ask them to help us correct some of these deficiencies, and we're getting a lot of static from the public saying, well, how much more do you want? You're special. They're telling us that we're specially treated because we got all these houses and et cetera and special treatments, which it isn't no special treatments. If this is what they call special treatments, then they should share in some of it. But I just wanted to touch upon the houses as that they're poorly constructed, the foundations and the insulation. I know the federal government said that this formaldehyde insulation wasn't supposed to shrink, but we just documented it just this summer or spring, showing the, we cut sections out of a burnt down building where the formaldehyde was shrunk down away from the studding and away from the top of the sills. But these are the things that makes people disbelieve or distrust other people, and or we feel slighted or slammed, as well as some other things that's happening in the village up there in Haines area, where they put the road through right through a grave site, native grave site, and they didn't say anything about it. I mean, the people there told them that we didn't want the road through there, and they built a road through there, and you could see the skulls right there from our forefathers. But we don't say anything like that because we don't like to make waves to these non-native in state, because we're trying to work with them, but they don't work with us. And you add all these little things up that stored up behind us all the time, because they always, you know, we still want to work with the people, but it's feel like it's going to be an upheaval of some kind. People are just going to stop. You know, I mean, we're going to still work with each other, but it's going to be on like our terms or similar to that. They're going to have to stop and listen. But this is all I have to say, that the buildings that we got from the HUD is... Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strong. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Arnold, Deputy Commissioner of Natural Resources. I've come today because I understand a question was raised with regard to the state of Alaska's stance and the land bank, which is authorized under ANILCA, under the Alaska Native Lands Interest Act. And I have come to inform you and your commission of the state's position. It is possible, of course, at present, for Native corporations to enter into arrangements with federal agencies for the preservation of the land base under the management of such federal agencies, even if the lands are not contiguous to those of the Native corporation. And there are very real benefits to such a Native corporation: protection against claims arising from adverse possession, continued insulation, continued protection from...
Thinking of houses.
Yes, that's right. continued protection against taxation for lands that are not developed, protection against suits that might arise against the protection of the land against suits that might arise against the corporation. And these are the benefits that are spelled out in the land bank, together with continued fire protection. The period of grant of interim benefits ended in December, and so there will be an increasing level of interest, I believe, among Native corporations in exploring how they might enter into arrangements with federal aid and later state agencies. I wanted to say these few words of background before I talk about the state's position. When I say that the period of interim benefits is ended, I really mean only for those corporations whose lands were conveyed prior to December 2nd, 1980. There was a 3-year grant of interim benefits, and that 3-year period of interim protection against adverse possession, taxation, and suits will begin in each instance as a Native corporation is conveyed land to it. But perhaps 20 million or 22 million acres had been conveyed prior to the date of that act. And so, as I say, I do anticipate increasing interest among Native corporations in the land bank. The first corporation to make substantial progress in discussions with the federal government has been Ghana U, a 4-corporation merger in interior Alaska. and that group has, at considerable expenditure of time and effort, developed an agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is nearing its final stages. Given this background, the state of Alaska has designated the Department of Natural Resources as the lead agency for consultation in federal agreements between Native corporations and federal agencies. At present, however, it is not possible for a Native corporation to enter into a land bank agreement with the state, which itself owns 78 million acres in the state today. The reason for this is that no authorizing legislation has been enacted. This year, however, during the legislative session, we began examining in a small group within DNR and in consultation with Native corporations the desirability of corresponding federal legislation. We recognized that we could not... State legislation which would correspond to the federal legislation in its general ways. That's correct. We have, Governor Sheffield has named a mini-cabinet on rural issues, of which I am a member, the department is a member, and I am the usual representative. And that group has now identified development of an Alaska land bank involving the state government as a priority for this coming half year or three-quarter year, the time ahead between now and the next legislative session. What we will be doing is consulting with the Office of Management and Budget, with the Department of Revenue, with the Department of Law, and we anticipate as an outcome of those meetings the development of draft legislation to propose to Governor Sheffield. So I am hopeful that by this time next year, such legislation may become law. Have you any questions? Some of which I may be able to answer and some of which I may not.
Well, the three-year blanket protection provided by ANILCA that applied to all lands conveyed ran out in December 31st, 1983. Have I got that right?
That's correct. For those lands that were conveyed before the passage of ANILCA.
So that you anticipate an interest by corporations, regional and village corporations, in utilizing the land bank provisions of ANILCA now that blanket protection has run out.
I do, and I don't base that just upon the reading of the law, but I was an active kind of half-member of Alaska Native Land Managers, that is, as a representative of an agency. I wasn't a Native Land Manager. So at regular monthly meetings, we talked of the land bank. In fact, the land bank was a subject of a special presentation by Pat Sweetser at the recent meeting of the Native Land Managers. These are the Village Corporation Land Managers earlier this month, May 9th, I think it was, in Anchorage. And I think there will be growing interest because it is new, even on the federal front. In other words, as a matter of implementing legislation, there may be a sense of caution here and there, and maybe a sense of uncertainty about how it's going to work. So I think corporations are watching closely to the Ghana-U experience and wanting to discover what promise it may hold for them as they seek to preserve the land base.
Could you tell us a little more about the Ghana-U experience? They are the first corporation to seek to utilize the land bank provisions of ANILCA, I gather.
The first that I know of, yes, which they have developed a 25 to 30 page draft agreement, which is in the final stages of review by the Department of Interior. And Pat Sweetser has kindly furnished it to me, and so I've read it once, and I can perhaps characterize its contents. The corporation would allow the management of about 300,000 acres of its lands. It could be 400,000, but 300,000 to 400,000 acres of lands already received to be assumed by the Fish and Wildlife Service to be managed under as part of its general management scheme for that refuge in that area. In order to receive the benefits, the corporation would grant certain easements for the for the actions that the federal agency might need to take. It would also, well, let me see what else the corporation might give up. It would not give up the right to allow specific uses to take place. The principal thing that the corporation would give up, of course, is the right to develop the land. It remains sort of part of the refuge regime. What the corporation there is proposing is a 10-year agreement with Fish and Wildlife Service, and it's revocable.
It's irrevocable?
No, it's revocable by the corporation. I obtained my copy, or actually I have several copies, so that I could analyze the progress of negotiations and the state could thereby profit in its own planning from the land vice president, Pat Sweetser, or from Max Sundorf. I would query him, but I'm confident he would be happy to make it available to you, for instance, for your review. I think these are kind of fundamental papers to see how the federal agency in this case and the corporations disagreed and what kind of compromise was necessary in order to strike the agreement. The native, the AFN itself, had a task force working on this and produced a few papers about a year ago, raising a number of the issues of the land bank. And I think the conclusion of that steering committee or staff group was one of some optimism that indeed it was a promising provision for native corporations.
The if there were when you speak of corresponding state legislation, you're referring to assuming that the administration found it acceptable and the legislature passed it to legislation that would would enable an agreement such as GANAU has with the Department of the Interior. Such an agreement could then be made between native corporations and the state. Is that the?
Yes, that's correct. And in some areas of the state, it would be very important. It makes good sense in areas in which the state is the principal neighboring landowner for the state to be entering into such a cooperative arrangement instead of a distant federal land manager. It will be of less importance to western and northern villages, for state selections of land are more often in south central Alaska, interior Alaska, some on the Seward Peninsula, however, though. So it would be a matter of little importance, probably, some corporations that the state had such legislation.
Is GANAU putting the land in the land bank, and I, until the agreement is signed on both sides, I suppose it isn't in there. What is the purpose that they have in mind? Is it to be used for subsistence? Is that the primary purpose? Is it to immunize it from taxation, adverse possession, and all of these other things?
I think it's these several things. Perhaps I, and this should be noted as a surmise, because I talked with Pat once on the telephone, the vice president for lands. Certainly those benefits are important. Immunity against taxation, immunity against insulation, what I was looking for. The trespass problem would be a worry for the Fish and Wildlife Service and not for a corporation with limited cash assets. And similarly, protection against these suits, so those immediate benefits. The cooperative agreement which has been developed promises the people of the area that there will be no interruption to their use of the lands for food gathering, traditional subsistence uses. So it seems to me, in addition to the specific benefits, that the corporation is setting out to act wisely for its stockholders by letting some of those burdens, often costly burdens, of land management be borne by a public agency whose resources are greater. And the public agency, in turn, can rationalize, or let us say justify, its expenditures on the grounds of a rational land management scheme for the area. In other words, it would be concerned about perhaps it has a couple of million acres to worry about trespass, and it would have a few hundred thousand acres more which to worry about. But I think it's a fair surmise the corporation's leadership believes it to be of real benefit to the corporation as corporation and to its stockholders. And I know it is, I think it's fair to say the corporation is growing impatient that it hasn't realized its final agreement yet.
And I think you said that this land that Gunnayu wants to put into the land bank is contiguous to a federal wildlife refuge.
Yes, that's right. Well, they may be surrounded by it. I should have checked the map before I left. They may be surrounded by it.
Would this imply any alteration in the regime relating to the regulation of subsistence? Would going into the land bank in this particular case mean any change in effect in that?
I don't think so, except they will have a paragraph signed by the Department of Interior, one more measure of assurance, perhaps, that subsistence activities may continue.
I see. While you're here, Mr. Arnold, could you, if it's something you feel able to do, discuss generally problems connected with the conveyance of land after the passage of ANCSA, and because at one stage you were the man appointed to expedite the whole process. We've got you here, if you could dilate on what occurred.
Although it is true, perhaps by rambling a little, if you'll all forgive me,
well,
I'll recall some of it. It was my good fortune to be, in timing, to be named to the Bureau of Land Management position at the same time Native Corporations successfully modified and improved the easement regulations. So owing to that matter of timing, in part, the pace of land transfers to Native corporations did substantially hasten following my appointment in November of 1978. But I want to make sure it's not just cause and effect here. What corporations had done was file a lawsuit against the Secretary of Interior. I'll go to the 71-78 period. I think part of the delay, and I'm not on the payroll of the Department of Interior anymore. I'm trying to make this account as accurate as I can make it. But I think part of the delay was understandable. It was a very complex piece of legislation that had to be understood. And rules had to be devised. As we all know, laws generally describe regulations or guidelines or instructional memos go on to specify how it will be done and what sequence. And so I think, in part, some of those early delays may be attributed to the difficulty of understanding or the difficulty of spelling out how this law is to be implemented. A second problem, of course, perhaps not a problem, but corporations had until, village corporations had until 1974 to select, and regional corporations had, broadly told, until 1975. So there was a period of time in which selection would take place. The easement issue, though, was a major one in those early years, for the law provided for easements to assure that persons would be able to reach public lands, by and large, for that purpose, access. Persons of differing positions disagreed, however, on how that should be construed. Some of the leadership in the Department of Interior seemed to Native corporations to be overzealous in its efforts to assure access, for instance, streamside easements, all along streams easements, and proposed future rights of way crisscrossing the state. To Native corporations, it looked like the federal government was taking back with easements what the Congress had indeed agreed upon to transfer as private property. And the Chilista lawsuit settled that the Secretary of Interior had gone beyond his authority in these first regulations that had been drafted. Unfortunately, and I wasn't there at the time, but my understanding is that those first regulations had not been done in consultation with representatives of corporations, statewide or regional or village corporations, and they were marred by that narrowness of view that federal or state agencies will typically have unless they open up the process to public hearings. The lawsuit set things right. I think that was settled in 76. I know the regulations weren't adopted until 1978, November of 78, but there was a long period of discussion involving representatives of Native corporations and the statewide Native organization that ended up producing the 1978 regulations. By 1978, something like 5 million acres had been transferred from the BLM to Native corporations, but I think that really represents like the four-year period, say 1974 to 78. Since 1978, I think that we must be approaching the 30 million acre figure now, although I'm not altogether sure, because I've been gone from BLM for a year and a half. But I think I may be leaving out the most important one, but just by going by recall, it seems to me the easement issue is a major one. Even though special agreements were negotiated with Native corporations to solve the easement matter later and go ahead and transfer the land, that was a useful expedient for some corporations who had an urgent need to obtain land for development purposes, for instance, or to resolve some issue. Pardon me. But quite a number of corporations were very explicit. They did not want to sign any agreements with the Department of Interior on the basis of promised repairs later. They said, we'll wait for the new regs, nothing is pressing us, our lands have the protection of the withdrawal, and frankly, we'd rather wait. This was true, incidentally, even past 1978. Corporations did use different strategies. Those with substantial resource that could be transformed into the benefit of the corporation and stockholders would be much more eager to obtain the land at an early date. Others recognized the costs that would be borne and said, that's quite all right. For instance, one multi-village corporation said to me, when they came to see me at BLM, I thought they were going to hit me over the head because they were nowhere on our following year's schedule. They said, no, we're glad, we want to stay off next year's schedule as well, and perhaps the year after that, because we want to engage in some land use planning. We've gotten a small grant, we're going to put up some of our own money, and so we'd like to have a better sense of where we're going before that day arrives and you hand us title to about 1 million acres. So corporations did follow different strategies depending upon the unique circumstances of each. I might try to consult my memory and recall some more reasons, but it seems to me I had 5 or 6 in my head at one time. There, we introduced a new delay in the post-78 period, but it was desired and respected by corporations, and this was a consultation with the corporation before we delivered the title document. Even with expert land law examiners, and BLM does employ such, and I know many of them, errors can occur, and this would allow a close review. Secondly, it allowed corporations to offer a final round of comments on the easements we proposed to put in the land that we were conveying. And then we would travel to the village and meet with the corporation. And on some occasions, the corporation would say, these three easements are, they're pretty legitimate. They seem to meet the test of law. But this other one, makes absolutely no sense, the corporation would say with sometimes some amusement, because the easements were lines on a map and the people of a village know the area very, very well, and they would often find the route laughable because we had not been in the field. So we often corrected the alignment. These were often, these were useful meetings in that they improved the understanding on the part of the village corporation as to what lands were being transferred. and they improved the understanding of BLM staff and myself as to the foundations of Native viewpoints with regard to the land transfers themselves. And those meetings, I understand, are still taking place. So there are some, I think, forgivable delays that are now introduced in the process. I don't know that it's a matter of much controversy anymore, though, about the rate, the pace of transfers.
A couple of other things that perhaps I might ask you about.
Say hello here. John, it's really nice to see you after all these years. One of the principals from the 1960s.
The land bank provisions of ANILCA are designed to give corporations a means to preserve land for subsistence, to immunize it from taxation, the presumption being that subsistence doesn't produce a surplus that would enable any tax on land to be paid, and so on and so forth, and you discussed that at length. At every meeting this commission has held, including here in Juneau last night and again today, proposals have been made for Native corporations to assign their lands to IRA councils or to some other institution that would hold the land in trust, thus achieving the purposes of land banking, but also immunizing the land against their loss through the loss of control of the corporation after 1991, assuming after 1991 that is the kind of thing that may occur. I'm not putting this very elegantly, but have you considered whether the transfer of corporate lands to IRA councils or to some other institution that would hold lands for Native villagers or some larger group of Native people in trust? Have you reflected on it, or have you any comment to make on it?
I think the question of whether transfer of lands to the IRA may result in that outcome of trust status is a question of law, and so one that I can't really comment on. I did attend, I've been set to thinking about it, because in December 1982, I was sort of a keynoter for a conference held in the interior by Doyon and Interior Village Association. What I said on that occasion is not much worth remembering, but the debate that ensued among a number of invited speakers I thought was very, very useful. That session included representatives of the IRA idea, some attorneys who have represented corporations and won their respect and asked their advice at this meeting, kind of lectures, and representatives of Native corporations not clearly aligned with one idea or the other. The land bank was discussed at that meeting. One attorney cautioned that it would, that the, in his view, if I recall a couple of things, he would not want to spend too much money on untested legal theories, and so he was expressing a caution for those who expressed some confidence in being able to put land in the land bank. Transferring land to an IRA. Thanks. Another, I think that was Arthur Lazarus, a Washington, D.C. attorney, long representing Doyon. David Wolfe, who has represented a number of different Native corporations, I think echoed that view, and then he raised an important question for corporations, not one that he as a lawyer should answer, one that corporations needed to consider, and that was how fully they wanted the Department of Interior, again, an active part of their lives. I stayed out of that debate. I think that, I guess I would agree with both of those propositions, but it's sort of really none of my business. I mean, I'm just a citizen. I'm not involved in the issue. I do think the land bank has much promise and will soon have some experience upon that can be built upon, and it may be less costly than other approaches. It may not deliver what I read some native representatives are particularly desirous of obtaining, and this is a renewed sense of self and community identity and preservation of cultural ways. And the land bank doesn't promise that. I think the most it can promise is a traditional way of life and the food gathering, then the land management sense. But the land bank is a much better idea, I think, now than I did when it was first proposed as a part of ANILCA and I read about it. Because what my own understanding as an observer in the 1960s that Alaska Natives were seeking was security of tenure. Many not looking for a land claim settlement at all, that's my memory, or money, or corporations, but an end to federal agencies taking over traditional lands for an Air Force installation, or the state coming in to select for a recreation area or some other purpose. So the Native Claim Settlement Act, even combined with the land bank, promises that, not to eternity, because each of these agreements would have a fixed duration. But I think it's a promising development that needs to be addressed.
I just have a couple of other questions that have you reflected on the provision of ANCSA that says that the subsurface estate of village lands is to be held by the regional corporation? In the villages that I've been to holding hearings, there has been widespread resentment expressed about that. And I just, you wrote the textbook on land claims, you've written articles on the subject since. I wondered if you had any observations to make in the light of 12 years.
It seems to me when the idea first came up before the act was passed, it looked like a good way of achieving that sharing of resource wealth, which was partly the a kind of driving force. For after all, the Settlement Act, though it was meant to satisfy claims of ownership to land, was being enacted in a time of concern by the Congress and the President for a decent life for all and greater equity of opportunity among all Americans. And so, much to the annoyance and